and welcome to this One Time at Summer Camp, a podcast about summer camp. My name is Peter, and today I am not joined by Nick. Today I'm joined by Chucks.
Hey, how's it going?
So, this is exciting. Been wanting to speak to Chucks on the podcast for a long time. Today we're talking about fear and heights activities. And so, unfortunately, Nick couldn't be on this episode. One, he's never worked any heights activities. And two, the man has no fear. Zero fears, never been afraid. So he wouldn't really be very useful. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how much time you spent at summer camp and kind of what stuff you've done?
Right, yeah, of course. I mean, firstly, thank you for having me. Spent about four summers working at camp. First year was working over at the skate park and then the Alpine Tower. And then those last 2 years, I was on the program staff looking over land.
Yeah, we were both at Camp Moose Spine together at the same time for those, 4 years. So, got to know each other pretty well, I'd say.
Yeah, been through it all.
Okay, so the whole premise of wanting to do an episode about fear is that when I was at Camp Moose Spine, I never worked at any heights-based activities. I only worked at sailing. And then when I started working in Australia, all of a sudden, I worked at all of the heights activities. Like, we had four different high ropes courses that all worked on different systems. Abseiling, rock climbing, indoor rock climbing, outdoor. I had this thing called a power fan. You ever heard of that?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into that later. And we had three different giant swings of three different heights. So I got really well versed into heights activities, even though you and I never worked any heights activities together, which would have been cool.
Would have been cool, yeah. Of course, I mean, the way our camp was broken down, the land stuff and the water stuff, like, we never mixed, so yeah. Barely saw you about at all.
It's crazy, like, if you land on water, you don't mix that often. If you're on opposite staffs, so like you have time off at different times,
true,
then you really never see each other. If one of you's on land and the other's on water, you're on opposite staffs and one's a boy and one's a girl, then that person doesn't exist to you in a camp setting. You can go like 4 weeks and go, who the fuck is this person?
There are definitely a couple people that come to mind. I'm like, I know your face. I barely know anything about you. I feel so bad. Like, looking back at that yearbook, I'm like, when... Who's this person like?
you get to the end of 10 weeks and you're like, I haven't spoken to this person once. That's not ideal. So I'm going to kind of start off by talking about what it was that I did in Australia. So we would have groups of 30 kids come to us for like 2.5 days. Mm. So they'd arrive on like a Monday, you'd do two activities, they'd have dinner, night activity, and then next day they'd have... breakfast, two activities, lunch, two activities, dinner, night activity. And then they'd have two activities on the Wednesday and then leave, and the same cycle would repeat Wednesday to Friday. I've come to think that that system of doing activities is definitely not my favourite way, because the system we had set up at Moose Pine was everyone got to choose whatever they wanted to do, really.
Yeah, you gave the kids who went there, the campers there, a lot of agency, like blocks of three, I believe. Mm. Can remind me if I'm messing up, and then an hour each activity and just walk to the next one. So I thought it was quite a nice system. And you're saying with yours, maybe I'm being presumptuous, it's almost like you're churning everyone through. It's like a lot. It's quite,
yeah. I mean, people often talk about how, you know, we only saw kids for 1 week at a time most often, and the fact that some other camps have them for 2 weeks or you know, a month at a time. And so trying to get to know kids for 2.5 days, and then you get a new set of kids immediately afterwards. Like, you're not making too much of a impact, I feel.
No. And I just had a thought. Just like, my challenge to myself was each week, everyone who visited the land activities, as the land program director, I'll try learn their name. Mm. So by the week, I'm like, 200 names, 100 names. And I'd always give like someone like a descriptor.
Yeah.
But it got so chaotic, and like that week would be done. Like, all right, here we go again. Let's do my own brain training here.
New week, new kids.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, I can see that being really tough of just like even not even remembering their names. Just like, yeah, that impact again.
Yeah. So we would have like a schedule printed out, and whatever the schedule was for your group number, you know, I'm group number 3, you had to go and do those activities. And so sometimes you get quite a nice schedule where it like eases the kids into the activities. You start off with something a little bit easier, like rock climbing, and then maybe, you know, you do some canoeing and archery, and then you progress into, you know, something a bit more fear-inducing, potentially, like the giant swing or like power fan. I'm going to have to pause and explain power fan for those who don't know. Right, picture a telegraph pole, a massive lamppost, basically. You climb up to it. There's two little platforms either side. And so when you're at the bottom, you're wearing a full body harness. You get clipped into the back of it with a carabiner, and you start climbing up the pole, and it auto-retracts. So it keeps tension in it. And so there's like a spring at the top. As you climb up, you get to the platform. You then step off the platform, and you start falling quite quickly initially. And then it slows your descent until by the time you reach the ground, you land pretty softly and gently on the ground.
Okay, yeah, I've definitely heard of those. I think I had a couple of friends do out of bound describe the same thing. But you called it a...
Power fan is what we called it.
I'm not making a connection of the fact. Does it make a noise or something?
There is a fan that spins. So you hear a... as they jump down. But, you know, to get physics-based...
Oh, come on, do it to me.
There's like a spring in there, and so you're storing energy into the spring as you descend. And obviously, the more you stretch the spring, the harder it becomes to continue to stretch it. And so that's why it auto-retracts. Like, the big thing you can't do is if you're unclipping a kid and going to clip the next one, if you let go of it, that thing's just gone up. And then you have to climb up and get it and
he's
come back down.
It this time, yeah.
So, yeah, real pain. So when you have an activity like that, there's the ability to have differentiation, like scaffolding for some of those activities. Like rock climbing, you can climb one third of the wall, you can climb halfway, you can climb all the way to the top. You can choose your level of like difficulty or challenge or...
Yeah, absolutely. The different handholds, the different level of difficulty or different colour depending on which bouldering centre you've gone to.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you start off with an activity like that, and that's a good way to get kids into those like fear-based activities. But occasionally we'd start off with abseiling, and that's just like, that is the reverse, you know. You start at the top of a very tall thing, and you have to go down. And so there's not really that much differentiation there. You can't really, you know, start halfway down the wall. I mean, sometimes they have smaller walls that you can abseil off, right? But it's really hard. The point I'm trying to get across is it's really hard when you have a group of 30 kids. Each of those kids are going to be unique individuals with different past experiences. And so the appropriate level of challenge for one of those kids is going to be different for each person. And so trying to, you know, do an activity and make it fun and relevant for all 30 simultaneously is a really difficult thing to do. And so, yeah... Particularly Power Fan, I quite liked because it was like it's safe no matter the height that you go to. So, like, if you go halfway up the pole and you let go, like, the mechanism will still catch you. So, technically, as soon as you're clipped in, you are incapable of hitting the ground. Now, funnily enough, I would sometimes demonstrate it for the kids to be like, look, if I can do it, it's safe. There is a weight limit for it. And, definitely. For at least some months, I was maybe like 5 kilos over that weight limit. There was a period of time in my life where I was 125 kgs and the limit was 120. So when I hit the ground, I'm hitting it quite quickly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
These little kids just float down like a feather in the air. And there's me going like... so it wasn't always the most reassuring thing.
Especially when you stand up and grunt, I'm like, yeah, it's fine, okay.
Yeah. But then you start to come up with these, like, methods for trying to help kids, you know, conquer their fears, get over them kind of thing. And so, you know, like for instance, giving them a countdown.
Mm-hmm.
Going, getting everybody to chant the countdown. 3, 2, 1, go. And, like, sometimes that's enough, sometimes it's not. And so each instructor would always have their own advice for, like, how to go about doing it, how to run it, what kind of things you should be doing. Did you find anything that was particularly helpful when you're like working at the tower?
I think my demonstrations, I tend to get either really goofy or really scientific with things. With the Alpine Tower, how that system is, you have your belayer, so you're down, and you have your climber connected with one rope. So as long as it's taut on your side as the belayer, it's that kid's going nowhere. They can climb halfway up, let go, and they'll just be at that same level. Like, they might not be holding onto the log, but they're just, yeah, still hanging there. And I tend to flip between two, and it's depending on older kids or younger kids. I'm like, hey, science has you.
Yeah.
You know, physics has you. See this one continuous line, you're not going to fall. Like, I've got you, you know? And I kind of reassure people in that way, or if anyone's having trouble in that regard. And besides that, just being goofy and maybe kind of keeping their mind off of it. It's like, oh, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Oh, still keep climbing as I'm saying all this silliness behind it.
Yeah.
And that tends to help every now and again. And again, it comes down to the individual. So some people respond better to certain stimuli than others. Again, that fear of going up this Alpine Tower is still within them, but how can you mitigate some of these maybe fear assumptions they have? Like, oh, I'm going to fall. I'm not going to fall. You're connected. Oh, I might not make it. I'm going to look embarrassing down to all my friends who are waiting for me. It's like, no, you give them encouragement. So there are always different techniques depending on what the situation calls for.
Yeah. And so after having discussions with my colleagues about like what are the different things that they do to help kids overcome their fears. So one of the quotes I would always say to the kids during my brief, because we try and give them a brief and try and pump them up and make them feel confident. One of the quotes I would do is, bravery isn't the absence of fear, it's being afraid and doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Which is a sentiment that I like, because it's not that you have no fear doing this activity. In the same way that, you know, I'm not brave for tying my shoelaces in the morning because there was nothing, you know, there was no fear with that.
Yeah, no real big adventure you got or something to overcome. Yeah. There.
And I think in the same way that like a skydiving instructor who's doing their 1,000th jump isn't brave for doing their 1,000th jump, you know?
Mm.
So it's the new, it's the unknown. And so in that way, we're not necessarily causing them to get rid of fear. We're teaching them how to manage fear, which I think is a really useful skill. And so basically, this led me to see if there was any research into fear-based activities, basically, heights activities. So what I did was did some Googling.
All right.
Google Scholar. I reckon I'll add a link to these in the show notes. Not that anyone's going to want to read them, but I just...
You'd be surprised.
Will, anyway.
Yeah, definitely. It'll be a nice thing. Nice to have.
It's good. First thing I wanted to do is, like, define fear, right? So the best kind of definition I can get is, the difference between fear and anxiety. So fear is a response to a perceived threat, and anxiety is worry about a threat that hasn't or won't happen. So if you're obviously standing at the top of a tall thing, you might feel fear about falling off that. So that's fear. But if standing at the bottom of a tall thing and looking up at it and thinking about going up it, then that's anxiety.
Right, okay. No, that's a good way of breaking it down.
I don't know if that definition necessarily makes sense to me, but like, obviously, anxiety is a disorder, right? So you can be anxious about lots of things, or have anxiety about lots of things.
Mm.
And then, you ever heard the phrase innate fear?
Innate fear?
Hmm.
Hmm.
No. So innate fear is supposed to be like fears that we are born with. You know, apparently there's only two innate fears, things that you're born with.
Can I guess?
Let's play the guessing game.
Okay, yeah, so definitely I've heard of this, but not the term. Primordial or innate fears, snakes, like something's in us that we see a snake, we're like, okay, I don't like that. Or maybe spiders. And the dark. How far off am I?
Neither of those are the two that I have.
Ah.
Which is interesting. Because I hadn't thought about the dark, and now I'm like, maybe there should be a third. Maybe that's just fear of the unknown. Not everybody grows up with a fear of the dark, though, do they?
No, but for me, I think of like a fear that everyone has. Like, where does it come from? The whatever, some caveman sees like a slithering snake. It's like, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay, darkness. Something's all around me. So I thought, you know, after generations of stuff, you know.
You definitely get a half point for snake because there's a bit of disagreement basically in the educational community. Some reckon or they refer to it as ancestral fear.
Ah, that's it. Okay.
So things that we've learnt from our ancestors over millennia.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah,
like snakes and spiders, basically. I think there's examples where kids aren't necessarily afraid of snakes and spiders.
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
So not necessarily innate in the sense that everyone is born with the same fear. Apparently, the two are a fear of falling.
Ah, true, okay.
And loud sounds.
Huh.
So when you hear a really loud sound, that causes like a acoustic startle reflex. And so your body automatically starts producing like adrenaline as a result of that. So your body's getting ready to do the like fight or flight response.
Oh, of course, yeah, yeah.
But the thing about falling, hear me out. The 1960s were a wild time. Somebody did a study on 6-month-olds to 14-month-olds, babies. And so what they did was they had the babies crawling around in this room that was very, very high up. And you know how if you go to some really tall towers, they have like a plexiglass floor so you can see through to the bottom?
Yeah, pretty freaky those.
And so what they did was they placed a bunch of babies up there crawling around and they waited to see if any of them would crawl over the precipice where it changes from plexiglass to regular floor. And none of the babies, some of them got up to that point, looked and like turned around.
Their eyes widened a bit. It's like, you know what? Not today.
I feel like you can do a study like that these days.
No, I was going to say, 1960s was wild, and scientists are just like, we'll see if it... Yeah, we'll just watch.
I just had all the funding and no oversight, apparently.
When did health and safety get invented?
So, innate fears, ancestral fears, if we're going with that, and then there's learned fears. People find Halloween decorations scary because they've been told that they're supposed to be scary, you know?
Okay, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
One of the other examples I read was like a combat veteran who comes across an IED in a plastic bag, which, you know, potentially blows up. They're going to gain a fear of plastic bags in the same way that, you know, they're back home and they might see a plastic bag on the street and they might feel fear as a response to that because they've learnt to know that plastic bags can cause harm.
I get that. Like, you're afraid of a bee if you've been stung before once when you're younger and it stays with you for a while.
Yeah. And then we're still kind of on the neurology stuff. I did quite a lot of research into this. There's
shows
two ways of processing fear. There's something called the low road and something called the high road.
Okay.
So low road is the signals that your brain receives are processed by the amygdala, which is a part of the brain, for those who didn't know. And then the second way of processing that information is through the high road, which is through the cortical center of your brain, and that is for reasoning and response to basically override the low road. So you hear a loud sound, immediately that gets registered by the low road and maybe causes an adrenaline spike, but then you think, oh, I've heard that sound before. That's the sound of a car backfiring. And then the high road kind of shuts that down, potentially. Or the high road goes, I have no idea what that was.
Get out of here.
We need to get out of here. Run. Run.
What are you doing here? Come on.
Run. Yeah. So that was all quite interesting to read. And so basically I found two interesting papers that I read. One of them was it was part of a larger study looking at a review of Outward Bound courses.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is interesting because we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
And so there were two Outward Bound courses. One of them was for women from New Zealand who were in the prison system.
All right, okay.
The other one was just like a voluntary one in the Czech Republic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and their results, what did they come up with?
They were trying to look at whether the fear-based activities were the greatest cause for growth. So they phrased everything in terms of comfort zones. So like getting people out of their comfort zone. There's the idea of, you know, your comfort zone is that circle that you're in where you feel happy and safe and good. And then there's outside of that is a learning zone where you growth and development can change when you're in new settings and new scenarios. And then beyond that is a danger zone. Danger zone? I can see you wanted to do it.
You saw me smile. It's like,
You gotta respect the logins.
Yeah. You're in my mind. Come on. Get out of there.
And so, yeah, when you're in the danger zone, it's like no growth or learning can take place because your body's shutting down, kind of thing. Like, I'm sure you've seen that at the tower where, I don't know, have you ever had anyone like get stuck up there?
Oh, yeah, a few times. And it seems like they refuse to move, but they just freeze. Completely freeze. And, like, you try to talk them down and they're barely saying anything. And, of course, we perform a rescue and get them down safely. But, yeah.
Yeah, so in that sense, they're overstimulated, right? Mm-hmm. And so, their body just kind of shuts down. And no learning can take place when that's happening, obviously. I have a story about someone getting stuck at the top of Power Fan. So, you know, here's me trying out all these new techniques for helping kids when they're scared of something. This girl was like, I don't know, maybe like 12 years old.
Okay.
She was quite short. And so she'd climbed up to the top and she was like refusing to jump off. So I was like, okay, sometimes I'll like climb up there with them on some Yates clips and then go and stand with them and talk to them and try and help them down. And so I climbed up there and I was kind of talking to her. I was like, you know, giving her encouragement and just trying to build up to a point where I go, 3, 2, 1, go. And then she just goes with it.
Yeah.
Because obviously, one of the things I found is the longer you spend up there, the less likely it is to happen.
Yeah, it's almost like you're talking your way out of it. This perceived idea of something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
And then it almost multiplies, like, it's going to go wrong like this, it's going to go wrong like that. And sometimes when you talk back to yourself, it's like, after you finished it, it's like, okay, I thought I was gonna fall, I was going to do this, my hair was going to get trapped in this. And a lot of them do become ridiculous. And once you're down there, it's like, okay, I've managed that at least. I can keep it moving. But yeah, it's always interesting to see people. You can kind of see it as you're looking up them working themselves up into this stew of fear, I guess.
Yeah. So the kids who spend 30 minutes up there, I would say 99 times out of 100 never end up going off, you know?
Yeah.
Like they, if it's not within the first couple of minutes, like odds are it's not happening.
Yeah. Time to perform a rescue.
But then, so performing a rescue in terms of the Power Fan is a little bit difficult because, like, I mean, they have to go off the platform, you know? I mean, I suppose it's the same in the tower in that, like, ultimately they're going to have to get off and get lowered down. And we do have a system to do that where, obviously, you can attach an extra rope and belay them down, as it were. But, hear me out.
Go for it.
I was like, all right, there's a little railing up there because you do kind of need something there just to steady yourself, but it also has the added danger of kids holding onto it. Like they refuse to let go. And so I've seen a kid try and jump off while still holding onto the railing.
Of course, like scoot off,
then just like, you know, nearly dislocate their shoulder kind of thing. Oof. And so I could get her to this point where she would take one hand off the railing, but not the other. And I was like, all right, we got to go, man. Like,
we
got places to be. I'm going to be in trouble if I don't get you to the dining hall soon. So I just, standing behind her, right arm round, pinning in that free arm, and then pulled the other hand off the railing and just chucked her.
Just let her be free.
Off the platform. And then afterwards, when we did our debrief, I kind of forgot about that, right? And I was talking about, you know, my job is to, you know, help you guys push yourselves to be the best kind of thing. She goes, yeah, you did push me.
Kids in these comments, just out of the blue. You know?
They, so that one turned out okay. I've also had a scenario where I pushed a kid and it definitely did not turn out okay. So now I'm like, definitely never push a kid.
Yeah.
I like, but this girl was like, I was like, okay, climb down then. That's fine. You can climb down. She was like, no. And I was like, well then you're going to have to jump off. No. You can't live here. Like, can't send your meals up to you.
Yeah. It's one or the other. Let's go.
So the fact she was refusing to go down.
Oh.
Yeah, that makes me sound better. The fact that she was refusing to go down necessitated having a. Forcefully remove her from the platform.
Yeah, let's just reframe that. I
mean, yeah.
She was just enjoying the view. I was like, this is too serene. Like, leave me alone, Pete.
And out of nowhere, just tackled her off. So learning zone, that's what you want. And so basically they did a bunch of surveys with all of these people in the Czech Republic and New Zealand. And they were looking at what activities caused the most learning for them. Like, what was the most impactful? What caused the most growth? And you think, you know, learning to manage your fear on a heights activities, that's going to be a pretty impactful thing. There's a number of people who felt that way and were, you know, thought the physical activities, the heights activities were the most impactful ones. But then there was also a whole bunch that, you know, it wasn't that for them. Even though they went and did those things, it was like maybe the social bonding or teamwork or other aspects. I've got a quote here I've written down. I'm not sure why, but I'm just going to read it and see what it says. So this is a quote from one of the participants, you know, evaluating their time on the course. It's got to be the mental. The physical was a challenge, but that's something that you do with your body, with your brain. The physical has been done and you can't bring that back with you. It's what you hold in your head that you can bring back with you. The most effective was that. Which is interesting, you know? It's the effect it has on your mind and not necessarily just doing the thing. Their kind of conclusion was that physical activities take people out of their comfort zone, but it's other aspects that they learn from. But quite often it was physical activities that preceded the learning that happened later. Right. So
the vehicle towards the
You know, I would feel sad if there were any summer camps that didn't have any heights based activities at all.
Yeah, I mean, you want all the kids that come through the gate to improve in some way, and definitely a little bit of physical activity and a little bit of no danger, but overcoming your fear is always appreciated. At least from my perspective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the second paper was the one I found a lot more interesting. It was based in like Scotland and Wales. Shout out Wales.
Yeah, currently here now.
We just climbed the highest mountain in all of Wales today.
Conquer some fears.
Yeah. Falling off a mountain, that is something I am afraid of.
Yeah.
Am I still afraid of falling off a mountain? Yeah. But did I learn to manage those fears? Yeah.
Of course, it's a good fear to have, just don't let it control you.
I only peed my pants once, so it was fine. So part of the point that this second paper was making was that lots of camps and activity centres and places like that do heights activities, but that they don't necessarily think about why they're doing those activities.
Ah, interesting.
Is that...
It seems kind of obvious to me, maybe... Because we've worked our activities so much and maybe you don't just see it as an activity. There's an added benefit of, like you said, like the main discussion we're having is overcoming our fears, working as a team. Like a lot of these core values that were instilled into us before during our training that we tried to impart in these activities. So, yeah, it's interesting that they don't see it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I might be misinterpreting that, but one of the lines was, adventurous activities act as a magnet for tough individuals and provide them with an opportunity to fully self-actualize. And so, yeah.
I wouldn't agree with that, actually. No. It doesn't sit too well with me, that statement.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of saying. I don't know if I can fully articulate why, but I think there's lots of people who are afraid of those kinds of things, but still want to do it, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of these adventure activities, like, let's say, Tough Mudder. I've seen a lot of people have gone to that who aren't necessarily the characteristic or type of adventurer. They just wanted to give it a go and see how it made them feel afterwards. So,
yeah.
Or at least I like to focus on those people.
Yeah, for sure. So the paper kind of broke down in the initial stages, talking about like the case for having fear at adventure activities or fear-based activities at camps, and then the case against having it at camps, which was interesting because I was like, what are the cases for not having it?
Yeah.
You know, I would have thought everyone thought that was a good idea. So their main case against it was like the potential harm that can be done when kids fail to learn to manage their fears in that scenario can sometimes be damaging.
Okay.
Does that sit with you?
That doesn't sit with me because failure is a part of life. It's a part of learning. I mean, some people would say the first step of being good at anything is to fail at that thing. Obviously, I mean, kids take a few things harder than they should, maybe, just how it is, depending on the character of the person. But failure is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, one of the people I look up to, they're an animator, and they say, well, one of their brilliant quotes are, every good artist has 1,000 bad drawings in them. So the sooner you get them out, the better your art's going to be.
Mm.
So essentially, sketch a lot. Right?
Yeah.
Make as many drawings as you can. Fail. You keep your drawings. You observe them. You observe your progress. That's going to make you feel better. Like having this tangible way of seeing, okay, look, I've improved. And two, just getting and doing the activity. Mm-hmm. Again, we touched upon the idea of, because I've worked with a lot of designers. I give talks at schools about design, building up your skills. And that fear is real of like, I won't be good enough. I'm like, well, you're just starting off. Like, no one expects you to be good. Like, I don't know how you would acquire these skills without doing this thing. So,
yeah,
that's why I feel like failure is good. Failing at the right time is good. I mean, add that caveat.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're kind of coming from the point of if you know, you can potentially come away from one of these activities being more afraid of it than you were in the first place, like if you have a bad experience on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, even that fits in with what you're saying, right? That's part of the... Sometimes it's not linear. You don't always go forward. Sometimes you go backwards.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
In order to go forwards. Yeah, for sure. So, case for fear. Pro fear. That's what we're saying.
Absolutely.
So basically... The way that they presented their research was they used something called vignettes, which are, you know, it's not a data-driven research like the participant experienced 3.5 fear.
Yeah. There's no scale.
Yeah. So vignettes are like illustrative stories with kind of emotional language built into them, which aren't necessarily the most objective and aren't necessarily... able to be applied to a wider context. But this particular activity they did was they were caving in Wales. So doing activities in caves.
Oh, okay.
And I thought that was really interesting because that's not something I've done at Camp Moosebine. That's not something I've done in Australia. And I'm like, oh, that's a whole nother dimension of fear.
Of course, yeah.
Particularly what you're saying, like, you know, fear of the dark. It'd be cool to lead a group of kids through something like that. I think that has added benefit that, like, there might be a kid who's super cool and comfortable with rock climbing or abseiling, jumping off tall stuff, but then you get them into a confined space in the dark.
Yeah, and it's just, it's a wrap. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, I wanted to read one or two of these stories to you and just see how it hits you, how it makes you feel. The group sit close to each other. The roof is low. The shadows are dark. Did you know a cave is the only place where we can experience complete darkness? The facilitator begins. Let's all turn our torches off. The group becomes agitated. Do we have to? One of them asks. They are distressed at the prospect of darkness. Their eyes are wide and body language is tense. It'll be fine. We'll just do it for 30 seconds. It's a worthwhile experience, the facilitator replies. The torches eventually go off. I turn on my watch backlight and glance at the time. It is pitch black. How long would this last for? The facilitator asks for silence. I can hear one of the participants breathing erratically. Please, can we turn our lights back on? The voice comes from the same participant who had just expressed their fear. They sound terrified, each sound wave fraught with increasing panic. Okay, the instructor replies. Let's turn our lights back on. Light returns. I glance back at my watch. We were in the dark for 121 seconds. I look around. Three participants are hugging each other, locked in an embrace which looks just as powerful as the darkness that had consumed us. One of the things that strikes me about that as a science teacher is trying to explain the concept of light to students. This isn't really relevant to what we're talking about, but trying to explain that... So I recently did something with a Year 7 class that I teach. So that's 11 to 12 years old for our American listeners. And so the question was, you have a poster on the wall, okay? You're in a room. There's no windows in the room. The door gets sealed shut, so no light can enter through the door. And obviously there's no windows. The light is turned off in there. Like, what would you be able to see? And so some of the options were like, you would still be able to see the poster. One of the options was like, the light would still be bouncing around the room. So the light would be trapped in there, even though you've turned the light off, so you'd still be able to see. One of them was, you wouldn't be able to see the poster at all. And very few kids picked the the correct option, which I'm sure we all would say is.
Oh, don't throw it to me. You're telling the story. I'm just listening.
I mean, you can answer my Year 7 question, right?
What could you see?
You're in a room, yeah, sealed shut. No light can enter from outside of the room. You turn the light off. What can you see inside the room?
Nothing.
Nothing, yeah, absolutely. There's no light. The light doesn't stay trapped in there and bounce around, and it's not just, like, really dim. But, like, how often do kids get to experience true pitch black?
Oh, yeah, I didn't really consider that. Rarely, no.
Yeah, like, quite often it's if you go caving, right? Sure. Like, well, to be honest, deep underground where there's absolutely no ambient light whatsoever. It's an interesting concept because, you know, I also asked them the same idea. Like, you're in this pitch black room and you hold your fingers centimetres in front of your eyes. Would you be able to see them? And of course you wouldn't, because your fingers don't emit light and there's no light bouncing off them and then going into your eyes, so you can't see it. But, yeah. So it's good to, like, challenge those misconceptions. That's not really talking about fear, though, is it?
No, and that story. I mean, but it gave me enough time to think of something that was interesting. Yeah. I would like to, you know, or something got held on to me. He said, or you can remind me the exact figure, like, the light was off for like 100 seconds, right?
Yeah, so 2 minutes.
So 2 minutes. Mm. I think saying that's really important. Like, having these markers of, like, I was afraid of the darkness for 2 minutes. Maybe next time, 2 minutes 5.
Yeah.
Maybe next time, it'll be double that. Actually, that's kind of one of the techniques I used at the camp we both went to. So, climbing the tower, of course, you have an easy, medium, hard route, or whatever, whichever route you've gone up. Kids would always get to a point of, like, all right, I'm okay, I want to come down. And usually, You get encouraged twice by me. That says, I think you could go a little bit higher. You give me two no's. I'm like, all right, you're coming down. So I say, let go. And they're kind of floating there. As I bring them down and unclip their harness and take the carabiner off and everything, I say, hey, look, see how far you went? Like, you're down on the ground, so it looks a little bit taller. How far you've gotten there? You can never be afraid of that height again. You can never be afraid of that height again, because you achieved that. So next time, whether it's you come back tomorrow, let's aim for a bit higher.
Yeah.
So I like having these achievements that you kind of, well, whether you give yourself or whether someone encourages you to acknowledge of like, you made it this far. Like, you'd be surprised. You know, that really helps, again, eradicate some of that innate fear that you have. Well, maybe not innate, some preconceived fear that you had.
The not realizing you can, you know, beat your own expectations kind of thing.
Exactly, that's it.
The instructor said they were going to turn the light off for 30 seconds.
Right.
And then turned it off for 2 minutes. And so that's that classic thing of, you know, oh, you only have to do this much. And then, like, I've had kids say, I only want to go halfway, okay? I only want to go halfway. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll let you know when it's halfway.
Yeah, I'll
let you know. And then they're 3/4 of the way up and you're like, they're like, am I halfway yet? I'm like, nearly. Keep going.
The white lies we tell kids. To help them improve, it's all good.
Sometimes they're really mad at that and they're like, you were supposed to tell me, but I'm like, but you smashed it, you didn't even know, you know, you can't be angry at me, you just beat your own limitations.
There it is.
So that's quite cool. One more of these, I reckon.
Yep, hit me.
A narrow gap in the rock is our next activity. The participants must place their torso in a wedge, tilt their head sideways to avoid their helmet getting stuck, and then are lifted and pushed through. One participant is clearly nervous. Can I go another way? They ask the facilitator. Yeah, we can go back the way we came, the facilitator replies, indicating the narrow crawl we had just completed. But what about all the way out, back to the entrance? Can I do that? They walk back and forth and are quickly becoming more distressed. Well, the instructor starts, if you want to leave, we all have to come with you. I can't let you go by yourself. They shake their head. I can't do that. Everyone will hate me. They have now crouched down, and their unease is clear. After a while, they stand. They do not look at either the instructor or I, but they announce they will try it. They place their head in the gap, but quickly withdraw. Head in hands, they slump to the floor. We are now silent. Again, they decide to look through the gap, but this time they put their head in and the facilitator picks up their legs. Go quickly, please, they shout, terror clear in their pitch. The facilitator pushes and the young person is pulled through by another participant. The instructor and I look at each other. They puff their cheeks. Oof, I didn't think we would get that one for a second.
I like the other story better.
Yeah. Sometimes you get that where you see kids go, all right, just do it. And like that's a good response to have, I think. You know, they're like, just get it over with.
Yeah, this hurried nature to your voice of like, just go. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah. And they, just scramble and go for it. I guess first thing that came to my mind when that wrapped up is this, whether it's social fear or anxiety, as they mentioned, like, oh, everyone's going to hate me if we turn around because I can't make it. And that is a massive fear that a lot of people have. I mean, I have. I'm still dealing with that. So it's interesting.
It feels a bit like trying to use one fear as a motivator, you know, something they're more afraid of. Like, oh, you know, you don't have to go through the gap, but there is a lion on the other side.
Yeah.
Sorry, behind you. Sure, so if you don't go through the gap, the lion's going to eat you. And it's like, oh, every person in your class is going to hate you if everyone has to go back to the start because you're refusing to do it. Mm. Like, I don't know.
I don't think that's the best technique. It's a technique, but I feel like at the end of it, no matter how many challenges you have, you've got this one massive fear behind you. It's like, oh God.
Trying to conquer your demon while there's a larger one standing behind
exactly.
you.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I don't know if that's the best best one.
Mm.
Okay. I'm going to read this one, which says, I feel powerless. Okay, guys, we have another challenge. This one is a bit of a squeeze. The facilitator indicates towards a narrow slit where the participants must shuffle sideways down a short corridor. Once inside, it is difficult to turn back. Participants ask lots of questions. What if I get stuck? Will I fit? Can I do this? One by one, the participants go through until the final three are left. The first bends their knees, and after some hesitation, is in, and the next steps forward. They have been perhaps the most scared so far. Tears are already in their eyes. Their eyes are huge. I have to do it, don't I? They ask the facilitator. You don't have to do anything. It's entirely up to you, they reply. They look through the corridor, tentatively edging forwards, and then disaster. They've not quite bent their knees enough, and their helmet becomes trapped in the wedge. The participant recoils back out of the gap in less than 2 seconds, and are on their knees, head in hands, and clearly sobbing. Are you okay? The facilitator asks, but they do not answer. With tears falling down their face, they go back to the entrance and squeeze through. The final participant follows, and I return to the main cavern to my right. I can hear the melancholy echo of deep sobs. After a short time, they resurface. Their cheeks are glistening amongst the torches. Tears continue to fall from terrified eyes. Their friend has their arm around them. The facilitator and I have taken a step back. They are angry and upset. It's evident the impact fear has had in defining their experience with their previous confidence, self-worth, and character was replaced by nervousness and embarrassment. We did this camp at the end of year six, which is like 10 to 11 years old, right before we went into secondary school. And there was this one activity we did that was, it was a maze that you had to crawl through, but it was like pitch black. So there was a roof on it. Oof, yeah. So you were in a tight, confined space. And yeah, I was only 10 at the time, but like I was definitely one of the larger kids. It was, that was scary, you know? It was basically pitch black. There were some little hatches that you could potentially get out of halfway, but like it took, you know, like maybe 20 minutes to get through it. And none of the heights activities kind of scared me at the time, but like that was definitely, you know, being a big person trapped in a small space. Like, right. I definitely get the fear that they were feeling there, you know?
No, I can imagine. I mean, 20 minutes in there and just in confined spaces. Like claustrophobia. Oh, my.
There's a reason why 127 Hours is a, you know, a highly rated film.
Yeah. It touches something in everyone, like, who watches it. I mean, I'm sure. Yeah, just as you read that story, that story pops into your mind, yeah. Having that shared fear of, like, tight spaces and, oh, yeah, awful.
So I think the final point I would like to kind of finish off is that, you know, these kind of fear activities, as best you can, you should try and take into account people's previous experiences, you know. Ideally, it would be individually tailored on a one-on-one basis in terms of, like, if you're scheduling the activities for them. If they've already done a bunch of stuff before, then you can put some more challenging stuff in there. If right. they've never done anything, like, you want to start slow and kind of build it up from there. You know, give them early wins that are easy to achieve, and then they're more likely to try other things with more confidence.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it takes one thing, like that kid getting their head stuck, and then they refuse to do it.
It's a wrap from there.
So, yeah. If you can avoid any of those things happening, those roadblocks, that's the biggest help.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that's kind of all I got.
Okay, ask you a question.
Yeah.
How do you deal with fear? And maybe whilst you think, have a moment to think, because I've got something fresh in my mind. Like one of my favourite books. Made by one of my heroes as well, David Kelly, the guy who started a company called IDEO, a design company. And here's this book, Creative Confidence, that kind of delves into, obviously, creative individuals who are trying to break into the industry and kind of like some of the missteps that you have kind of based on being afraid in yeah. some shape or form. So with the touch the snake analogy, it is, imagine You're in a corridor, and there's a door in front of you. In that door, there is a snake. So you're definitely afraid of snakes. You wouldn't even be close to one, right? But what if I told you, let's break these steps down. There's a snake in that room. You are going to touch that snake. So initially, I put you in the corridor. That's actually step one.
Yeah.
The fact that you're there. Then I say, hey, come to the door. There's a snake in this room. Do you want to come in or not? Like, you've already made it this far. You go into the room. Obviously, you go to where the box is. And I say, it's up to you. Do you want to open the box or not?
Yeah.
And then you are taking these steps, these very obvious steps, of course. Yeah, maybe obvious at the time. But you're... I'll say this instead. You are taking these steps to overcome this fear. Let's say it's whatever, 9 or 10 steps touching the snake, right? And then as you touch the snake, you get comfortable, then you pick it up, you wrap it around you. Essentially, the whole analogy is, like I said again, like all these different steps of conquering these smaller fears, like having these smaller wins and then eventually achieving this thing. So I shouldn't be afraid, or I've mitigated some of the fear I have around this subject matter. Mm. So that's the analogy they use for that. Obviously, the rest of the book is highly skewed towards design. So this is presenting in front of people. I don't know how many times you've spoken in front of a large crowd. Obviously, I know you talk to a bunch of kids every day for your work. But I was... in front of CEOs in exhibition halls. I've had, been in museums to talk to a lot of people. And again, if I just did that off the cuff, I'd be absolutely bricking it. But because I had these moments to like practice at one point, like engage with people in a smaller room and then build my way up. That's how I like to think of fear and just kind of like going for it.
Yeah, you're kind of like scaffolding, like differentiating it yourself for you, breaking it down into those smaller steps, and each one of those seems more achievable than the thing as a whole, which is good. That's nice.
That's right.
I think to answer your question, like the way that I approach it is, I like to think that I'm quite a rational person. I try and identify what that particular hazard is and then look at the risk, like how likely that is to happen. So let's say it is picking up a snake. We have a snake in our science department, right? Corn snake, not venomous, was never bitten anyone. So like, I'm super chill picking up that snake because even if it does bite me, it's not venomous. So the worst that's going to happen is I have 2 small puncture wounds. That is the worst case scenario. It bites me. And the likelihood of that happening is super low anyway. So I'd say I'm not very afraid of that. If you were asking me to pick up a highly venomous snake, all of a sudden, you know, even if you told me it's a super chill snake, it's never bitten anyone, like it's a pet, but it is highly venomous, that's going to be more fear-inducing to me because the potential of what if that does happen, even if the potential is just as low for the corn snake biting me as the venomous one, it's still going to be more scary. I might still do it because I know the likelihood of it happening is super low. But, you know, you're asking me to pick up, like, I don't know why I'm sticking with snakes. A taipan, like the world's most venomous snake. Yeah, nah. Like, I would die if I got bitten. I might go near one because I know they're, like, pretty chill. But, yeah, there's no way I'd ever pick one up. You know, it's too scary. So I kind of base it on that. Like, I went skydiving when I was in Australia, and I was just like, if this was super dangerous, they wouldn't be running it, would they? Like, they would have been shut down by now.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no way.
It's like fear is whispering in your ear, and logic and reasoning is like, no, pipe down. What are you doing here? Get away.
Yeah. So, like you were saying, how you explain the science concepts to kids about, you know, why they're safe and why this activity has fully been thought through. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. That's a question I get quite a lot from kids. Has anyone ever died here? And I go, do you think we'd be open if they did? Do you think we'd still be right? You think we wouldn't have been shut down by now?
Right.
Yeah, I'm just trying to approach it rationally. So there's definitely some things I wouldn't do, but I don't know. Does that answer it in the context of fear?
I mean, You've definitely answered it. Yeah. How do you deal with fear? My question, with rationality.
Trying to high road it.
High roading.
Process it through my cortical. Fuck, what's that area of the brain called?
He's picking up the notes again.
Yeah, trying to process it through my cortical centre and not my amygdala.
Not the amygdala. Okay. Nice. Okay. Do you remember the last time you were afraid?
That's a great question. There's moments today where, like, we're walking down. It's raining quite a lot. It's very slippy. There's a bunch of loose rock that we're walking down in the rain. And so sometimes your foot hits, you slide. And so in that exact moment, I'm feeling fear because I think, you know, if I fall, like, part of the thing that's going through my head is, like, I'm a big guy. You know, if I fall, I'm falling hard and that momentum's going to keep me tumbling, you know. But then that disappears quite quickly. Or, you know, I'm trying to rationalise my thoughts and going, okay, well, as I'm walking down this loose section, I'm going to aim for this particular rock so that even if I do fall, I can only fall a couple of metres before I hit that rock and that's going to stop me so I don't tumble off the mountain to my death.
Right.
So definitely felt some fear then.
No, I mean, I'm the same. Like, yeah. I slept a couple of times today and, yeah, very rational fear of, as we're going down, like, watching my footing. And maybe this was an irrational thought of, like, oh, I'm going to put my foot down and it's all going to just fall from underneath me and I'm going to slide for a bit. And then I'm like, all right, irrational fear, I was like, all right, irrational thoughts. Let me have my own irrational thought. If I slip, I'm going to grab something and stop myself from falling. So I'm like, all right, the fear is there, but I'm going to keep going. I want to be off this mountain.
Yeah. get me back into the warm.
Yeah, get me dry, please.
I mean, waterproofs, something can only be so waterproof.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
At a certain point, it was just soaked to the core.
Yeah, soaked right through.
So the last thing that comes to mind as to when I was afraid, I was in Tasmania doing a road trip with some people. We went into this cave and did a little tour of the caverns, which was, like, really cool. At the end of the cave, so, like, in the darkest section, the instructor or the tour guide turned off all the lights and was like, does anybody want to sing? So it wasn't the tour guide, like, it wasn't the darkness that made me feel afraid. It was the thought of, like, singing in public, you know? And so there was, like, a long pause where she was like, come on, somebody, you know, have a go. Make some noises to start with. She was trying to ease us in. Make some, I think I did a few, yee-yee, kind of things. And I was like, man, I know all the lyrics to Misty Mountains from The Hobbit. Far over. And I was like, that would sound so cool in this cave with this echo. I should just do that, man. And I was like, I'm going to do it. And, like, you know, it was fear, paralyzing. I just couldn't do it. I really wanted to. It'd be super cool. But I was, like, nervous, embarrassed, worried, you know. I was afraid of doing it. And so upon leaving that cave, I was like, always be the person who sings in the cave, you know. Yeah. Always be the person who volunteers to do that. And I'm just going to try and use that as motivation for the next time something like that happens, you know. Remember that disappointment I felt in myself. Use that as a motivator.
No, that's definitely it. I wish would have been an amazing time. I'm sure they would have appreciated it.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes we can't get past ourselves. Huh?
Our own little hang-ups.
Mm. Next cave. It's happening.
We might go to a cave tomorrow, eh?
Oh, true, yeah.
Far over the misty mountains call. You need to learn the lyrics so we can harmonise in the cave.
Oh, let me pull it up. But I couldn't know when to harmonise, if I just read it.
It's only a minute and a half. Oh. It'll be grand.
The Wisdom, Zone.
The Wisdom Zone.
I must not fear. Fear is a mind killer. Fear is a little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. So that's from Frank Herbert's Dune. Yeah. And when I read it as a kid, that really stuck with me. I always use it as a mantra. And then, of course, Dune 2 has just come out, so it's fresh in my mind.
Yeah. That's the mum saying that, right?
So that is the first movie whilst he's going for the trial of the hand thing. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Awesome. Right. Well.
Very fun, that was. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. You can find us on Instagram at this one time at summercamppod. Send us an email, this one time at summercamppod@gmail.com. We've got a website, summercamppod.com. And it's if you haven't checked it out yet, we've plugged it the last few episodes. You really need to check it out. If for nothing else than to see the about the authors section for Nick and I. It's very good.
Great photos, I must say.
Yeah. Definitely real and not in any way enhanced.
No, of course not.
So, it's goodbye from me.
And it's till next time from me.
Peace.
See ya.
Okay, so the whole time I've been planning this episode and writing it, I've had one thing going through my head the entire time, which is a line from a song. So there's a song called Fear by Kendrick Lamar.
If I can smoke fear away, I'll roll that motherfucker up.
And then I take you first.
What do you think Kendrick's trying to say in that lyric? If I could smoke fear away, I'd roll that motherfucker up. And then I take two puffs. Is one puff the amount that is required to remove all fear? Or would the entire thing be required to remove fear? And he's saying he just wants to remove some of his fear. Two puffs worth of fear.
I think it's removing all the fear. And a second puff is just to make sure. It's like, I've got it in that first hit, but just in case, once more.
But fear is a useful survival mechanism.
Oh yeah, it's how we've survived and thrived in society. You know?
If you're not afraid of getting hit by a car, you're just going to cross the street, aren't you? You're never going to go to a crosswalk. Okay, bye.
See ya.